Welcome to episode 51 of the 3M Fear podcast. It was Christmas Eve in 1945, and the Sauder family was immersed in their holiday preparations in their home in Fayetteville, West Virginia. George and Jenny Sauder, along with their 9 children, were getting ready for Christmas Day celebrations. It was their tradition to let the kids open a few presents on Christmas Eve, with the main gifts being opened the next morning. Joe, the second oldest child, was absent that night. He was away having served in World War II and was waiting to be officially discharged in North Carolina before returning home. As the evening progressed, George and Jenny, along with their youngest child, Sylvia, were ready to turn in around 10 p.m. However, 5 of their younger children wanted to stay up a little bit longer. They wanted to enjoy the holiday festivities and wanted to play with their toys. Now, Jenny usually would not allow them to stay up that late. But on that day, because it was Christmas Eve, she decided to let them stay up a little bit longer. But she gave them one condition. They had to complete their chores before bed. These chores would include closing the blinds and curtains, locking doors, washing the dishes, and taking care of the animals. At around 11:30 p.m., Jenny, George, and Sylvia went to bed. 2 of the older boys, John and George Jr., also decided to turn in and went in upstairs to their bedroom. The oldest daughter, Marianne, decided to stay up in the living room reading a magazine while the 5 younger children continued to play with their toys. The stage was set for the events that would unfold on this fateful Christmas Eve. Hello and welcome to the 3AM Fear podcast. I'm Nikita Ferrau, mystery and thriller author. On this podcast, I talk about real crimes and real people. Due to the graphic nature of some of this content, listener discretion is advised. You can find the episode show notes on my website, 3amfear.com. Let's get started. A small note here, I'm suffering from a very bad cold, so please excuse me for my voice. George Sauder was born as Giorgio Sauder in Tula, Sardinia in 1895. He then immigrated to the United States in 1908 when he was only 13 years old. He was initially accompanied by his older brother, who then left him, and then George was on his own. He found work in the Pennsylvania railroads, carrying water and supplies to laborers, and after a few years, he started work on his own. Initially, he would remove dirt for construction, and later on, he would do freight and coal work. One day, as he walked into this local store called the Music Box, he met the owner's daughter. Their meeting was more like match made in heaven. They would go on to get married, have 10 children between 1923 and 1943, and then settle down in Fayetteville. Regarding Jenny, she had migrated from Italy to America with her parents, and when she met George Sauder, she found him as a perfect match. Coming back to the night of Christmas Eve. As the night progressed, Marianne, the older daughter, had the responsibility to make sure that the younger children got into bed. However, she dozed off on the couch before putting the kids to bed. This left 15-year-old Morris, 12-year-old Martha, 9-year-old Lewis, 8-year-old Jenny, and 6-year-old Betty awake in the house. Around 12:30 a.m., Jenny Sauder was awakened by a phone call. She walked towards the office to answer the landline, and that's when she heard a woman on the other end asking for someone Jenny did not know. She also heard a man's voice in the background. Jenny assumed that it was a wrong number and went back to bed. She later told the local paper that the person on the other end had a weird laugh, and she thought that this was maybe some sort of a prank. She noticed that Marianne had fallen asleep on the couch, and because she didn't see anyone else, she thought that Marianne had probably put the kids to sleep and then she was down on the couch and that's where she fell asleep. As Jenny headed back to bed, she observed that the chores like closing the curtains, locking the doors, they were still not done. She thought that maybe the kids were too tired and they just couldn't do it, and so she decided to do it herself. Now remember, Marianne was still asleep on the couch. Jenny finished all the work and went to bed. However, less than an hour later, she was awakened once again, this time by a loud crash on the metal roof of the house directly above their bedroom. The sound was that of a hard ball or a rock hitting the roof and then sliding down into the gutter. Jenny listened for any further sound, but she didn't hear anything. She thought that maybe it was a one-time thing and then she fell back asleep. Little did the Sauder family knew that this was going to be the start of a tragedy. Sometime later, Jenny was awakened once again, and this time by the smell of smoke. She initially tried to reach the office to call for help, but was met with this intense heat and flames. She ran back towards the front of the house, screaming to alert her children. Marianne, who was still on the couch, woke up, grabbed her three-year-old sister Sylvia, and escaped the house. Some papers say that George Sauder was the one who took their daughter Sylvia, who was still in the crib, outside the house. So now Sylvia, Marianne, the two sons, George and Jenny Sauder, managed to flee the house. The two older boys, John and George Jr., managed to exit the house with some burns, but the other five kids were still upstairs. By the time George and Jenny realized that the remaining children had not come down, the flames had engulfed the staircase. With them not being able to go upstairs, George decided to use a ladder kept on the side of the house and then climb through a window. But when he reached there, the ladder was missing. In a state of panic, George tried to climb on the side of the house to reach the window where their kids were sleeping. But he injured his arm on a broken window and was bleeding heavily. Despite all these attempts, there was no ladder, and even though he tried to use his work trucks, they just wouldn't start in this freezing cold weather. There was no other way to get upstairs. The Sauder family were now racing against time. The fire was spreading really fast. The fire department also did not come on time, and this raised a lot of questions, especially against Chief Morris, because he did not communicate properly. The fire department at that time mainly had volunteer firefighters. So you can say something like freelance firefighters. They didn't have a proper team who would just get up and come. So finding the firefighters in the middle of the night was a little difficult. Marianne desperately ran to their neighbor's house and started asking if they could call an operator. The neighbor, who had already seen the fire, told that they had already contacted the firefighter team, but they had not gotten any response. Desperate, the neighbor drove into town and tracked down Fire Chief Morris, who initiated Fayetteville's version of the fire alarm. That is a phone tree system where one firefighter would call the other firefighter and so on, and finally all of them would come in one place. The Sauder house was burnt to a crisp within 45 minutes. Everyone, including the family members and neighbors, tried to call the firefighters. And the firefighters, with their trucks, came 8 hours later. The house burned down in 45 minutes, and the firefighter team came 8 hours later. Chief Morris did not give a proper answer to why his team was late. Also, the answer that Chief Morris gave to why this fire started in the first place did not quite fit into what exactly happened. He said that this was an electrical fire. But when the family was trying to escape, the lights in the house were still on. If this was an electrical fire, the power should have gone out immediately. Moreover, when Jenny asked the fire department for their official report, she was denied access. The fire chief said that the information was given to the insurance company and that it was up to them to share it. This lack of transparency and refusal to provide the family with the details that they wanted made them even more suspicious. Despite the official conclusion that this was an electrical fire, George and Jenny could not let go of this skepticism. They believed that there was more to the story, that their children were not dead, but something had happened to them. There was also no physical evidence. There were no bones found, there were no burnt out clothes found, nothing. It was as if no one had died in that fire. As I said, the authorities said that the fire was due to an electrical issue. But George and Jenny did not believe that. The lights were still on when they left, which means there was no problem with the electrical box. An investigation was promised to them that they would look into what happened to their children, but that never happened. Just 5 days after the fire, their children's death certificates were handed over to them. The incident gained widespread attention. Everyone came to see the site. They wanted to know what happened. It became more like a visitor's site or a tourist attraction for everyone. And George Sauder could not bear this. He didn't want people to come and keep staring at their burnt down house, especially knowing that maybe their children were inside. And so he brought in a lot of dirt, filled the hole, and then made this place kind of like a memorial site for their children. George and Jenny then moved into a new house just 150 feet away from where their old house was. George hired a man named Jimmy to fill this place with dirt. After filling the hole, George and Jenny turned it into a memorial site for their 5 deceased children. They laid flowers with each child's name and held a group funeral service on December 31st. Despite the community attending, George and Jenny couldn't bring themselves to believe that their children were gone. As time passed, strange details emerged. A bus driver claimed that he had seen fireballs on the roof on the night of the fire. The ladder that was usually kept in its own place was found 75 feet away in a ravine. Also, a man named Lonnie Johnson was seen taking chain hoists from the solder barn on the night of the fire. This raised even more questions. After the fire, it was discovered that the truck parts were being lifted with chain hoists from the solder barn around the time of the fire. A few days later, the Sauder family decided to get a new phone line installed, and that's when they noticed that their old phone line was cut. It didn't break off, it was cut. They believed that someone was trying to stop them from calling the fire department. Lonnie later admitted to stealing from the solder barn and also cutting the phone line. But even though he said that he did all these things, the authorities did not think that he was the one who started the fire or he had anything to do with the missing kids. Another strange thing happened when 4 strangers came to the Sauder family at their new house asking to see their babies. This interaction made the Sauder family very uneasy because already the police were talking, people were talking, and now someone was here at their doorstep asking to see their babies. For 18 months after the fire, George and Jenny accepted that what the police said was right, their children had died in the fire, there was no foul play. They kind of suspected that there was some sort of a foul play, but they didn't know who could have done it and why no remains were found. But they came to terms that their children were gone and would never come back. One day in 1947, Reverend Frame, a member of the local Masonic Lodge, learned from Fire Chief Morris, another lodge member, that he had found human remains at the Sodor fire site. Now Chief Morris said that he went back to the property on Christmas night, and that's when he found a human heart. He said that he buried this heart on the property in a box. Now Reverend Frame was both interested and shocked, so he decided to go and tell George and Jenny Sodor about it. To their shock, the Sodor parents had no idea about this. Chief Morris had never told them. It had almost been a year and a half since the fire. They had been begging for answers. And now here Chief Morris was telling this total stranger that he had buried a human heart in a box. They confronted Chief Morris, who casually told them, yes, he had found a human heart and he had buried it. The Sodor family insisted they wanted to see this heart and they wanted to know more information about it. George and Jenny were eager to find out this heart, but Morris started avoiding them. He would not talk to them, he would not pick their calls, he would try to make excuses, n number of excuses, when they tried to talk to him. Desperate, the Sodor parents persisted, and finally, Morris had to give up. He got the box dug up, and inside, they found an organ-like object. Morris said that it was a heart, although it didn't look like it was a heart. Suspicious of the local authorities, the parents wanted to get it investigated. They would take the liver to the funeral home and a portion of it was sent to a lab. Both the funeral home and the lab determined that it was not a human heart. Instead, it was identified as beef liver. And this organ had never been exposed to fire. There was no burning, no scarring, no scorching. It had never been in a fire. If it was exposed to a fire, it would have been cooked. But it showed like it was raw, something that you could buy from a grocery store. This created even more doubt on Chief Morris's actions. Why would he want to plant a liver, an animal liver, in a box on their property? The parents had tried to talk to Morris multiple times before this whole liver story had come out, and he said that he never found anything. And out of the blue, he told the stranger that he found a human heart, which was not even a human heart, a beef liver. Knowing that they were all on their own, they decided to hire a private investigator named C.C. Tinsley. Around the same time, the Sodor family found out that there was another tragic house fire where the skeleton remains were found. Now, this raised a lot of questions. The fire was similar, so why weren't their kids' remains found? Jenny couldn't understand how 5 children could die in a fire and nothing was found. They were made to believe by the authorities that their children were completely incinerated in the fire. Now, in order to discredit this theory, they decided to consult a mortuary and the cremation process. They were informed that even under intense heat for a long period of time, there would still be full bones left after the cremation process. Now, given the short duration of the Sodor fire, which was only 45 minutes, George and Jenny were surprised and they were told that they would definitely find some kind of remains because it was just 45 minutes and this was 5 children. George and Jenny Sodor began to doubt that all of their children's bones could have been reduced to ash in just 45 minutes. Now, George, who was successful at this point, wasn't well liked by some people in the community. He had strong views against Benito Mussolini, the Italian dictator. This caused a lot of friction with the Italian-American population in Fayetteville. George was more of anti-Mussolini, while many of the people supported Mussolini. So this created a lot of problems and also a lot of enemies for George. There were a lot of strained relationships, so it was definite that someone could be an enemy of this family. An employee at the crematorium told them that the bones would remain even if a body was burnt for 2 hours at 2000 degrees. And the house was destroyed in just 45 minutes, so it's impossible that no bones remained. Cleanne Chanito signed all 5 death certificates, and his relative Fiorenzo, who had co-signed for the Sauder house when they purchased it, was the sole beneficiary of their home insurance policy. Also, he had attempted to try and get George to, you know, increase the policy amount, and George said no. Just weeks before the fire, an insurance agent named Russell Long had approached them and tried to take out a life insurance policy on his children. The private investigator who was hired by the Sauder family, C.C. Tinsley, uncovered these suspicious connections. Fiorenzo was frustrated because George refused to take out an additional insurance policy. He warned George that his house would go up in smoke and his children would be destroyed if he did not listen to him. Shortly after that, a mysterious man approached the Sauder house asking for work. When George said no, the man said that this electric box could cause some fire someday. In the weeks leading up to the fire, the Sauder children noticed an unfamiliar car that was parked in their neighborhood. It seemed like someone was watching their family all the time. George and Jenny felt increasingly targeted, and they believed that there was some sort of a conspiracy against them. Eventually, George decided that he was going to excavate the site of the fire and see if he could find any evidence of his children. He did find some bone fragments, and they also found out that these were human bones, but just not of their missing children. When their memorial site had become a tourist site, George had taken a lot of soil to fill up. Apparently, this soil came from a cemetery, so there was a high possibility that these bones also got carried up from the cemetery, because they were human bones, just not of the Sauder children. Some people even speculated that the bones were planted there just to divert the Sauder family from searching any further. In 1952, Ida Crutchfield, the owner of a hotel in Charleston, claimed that 4 of the Sauder children, accompanied by Italian-speaking adults, had visited her hotel a few days after the fire. She tried to talk to the children, but then the adults came in between, and so she could not talk to them. Ida shared this information 7 years later, but the police did not investigate her story. The Sauder family's quest for answers continued. There was also this theory that maybe there was some potential ties to the mafia, but once again, this is all just theories. There was also this theory that perhaps their son Lewis was taken to Italy. They found a photo, and on the back of the photo was a very cryptic message. In 1969, George and Jenny traveled to Italy, hoping to find their missing son. They enlisted the help of an interpreter, but despite their efforts, they could not locate Lewis. The mystery envelope and the photo that they had received did not lead to their son. Over the years, the Sauder family would receive a lot of false news. It would take them to a lot of places, but not one where their children would be. The authorities refused to help them. They said the case was closed. All this searching and not able to find anything was taking a toll on their family. Now, the mysterious envelope that they had received with the photo of their child, Lewis, the Sauder family hired another private investigator and decided to trace the origin of this anonymous envelope that was sent from Central City, Kentucky. It had a photo of a man, and they believed that it was Lewis. Unfortunately, the investigator disappeared without a trace after heading back to Kentucky. Now, 2 possibilities are here that people believe. One is that either something happened to the investigator, maybe he found something and someone didn't want him to tell the Sauders and so he disappeared. Or he just ran away with the money. Unfortunately, the investigator was never found, and there is no way to prove what he knew. Even though there was no solid proof that the man in the photo was Lewis, George and Jenny wanted to desperately believe that it was their son and he was still alive. They had the photo enlarged, framed, and displayed alongside the pictures of their missing children. Now, another theory surrounding the case involves the Tennessee Children's Home Society, which was operated by Georgia Tan. This society was a front for child trafficking. Now, Tan had her ways of getting young children. Teenagers who became pregnant and had no idea what to do with their children, she would coerce them to give up their children. Sometimes it was said that she would even go around these poor neighborhoods where she would find these poor children playing around and then ask them to come and sit in her car. It was said that she would be driven around in this expensive black car and she would go to these poor neighborhoods or even a river or a lake, a place where you would find poor children playing around. And then she would ask the children to come and sit in her car and then kidnap them. There were two things that would be done to these children. One, they would be kidnapped, they would suffer a lot of abuse, and then they would be sold into prostitution rings. Second, if the child was really beautiful to look at, the child would be sold to a rich family, and then the family would adopt them. Although the society was shut down in 1950, after authorities exposed the illegal activities, over 5,000 children had been taken. And 19 of them had died. The Sauder family considered the possibility that maybe their children were also taken by this child trafficking ring, and that's why they could not find their children. Now, there is no concrete proof to say that yes, this is exactly what happened. It's just one of the many theories that are out there. In 1968, more than 20 years after the fire, Jenny went to get the mail, and that's when she found an envelope that was addressed to her. It was postmarked in Kentucky, but there was no return address. Inside that was the photo of a man, about 20 years old, and behind this was written, quote, Lewis Sauder, I love brother Frankie, Lil Boys, A90132 or 35, end quote. Now, the last time that they saw Lewis, he was only 9 years old. But they couldn't ignore the similarities between this man and Lewis. They both had dark curly hair, dark brown eyes, and they also had that same straight nose, the same upward tilt on the left eyebrow. Till the end, George and Jenny never gave up. They always believed that their children would come back to them. In an interview, George would say, quote, time is running out for us, but we only want to know. If they did die in the fire, we want to be convinced. Otherwise, we want to know what happened to them, end quote. He died a year later in 1968, still hoping that something would happen and their children would be brought back to their home. Jenny erected a fence around her property and began adding rooms to her house, layer after layer. Since the fire, she became completely paranoid and she never wanted that to happen to her again. Since the fire, she had worn black as a sign of mourning and continued to do so until her own death in 1989. There was a billboard put up with cash to anyone who could tell her where her kids were. When Jenny finally died, the billboard came down. Her children and grandchildren continued the investigation, but nothing was ever found. The question still remains, did the Sauder children die in the fire? If yes, what happened to their remains? If no, where are they? If they did die in the fire, who caused that fire? Because from their electric box, it didn't seem like the fire came from inside the house. So did someone purposely start the fire? Or was this all a conspiracy theory? With the time that has passed and no support from the authorities, the mystery of the Sauder children now remains as one of America's most popular unsolved cases. No parent ever deserves to go through this. A big thank you to all my fellow listeners who have been listening to all my episodes. Thank you so much. Your listens, your support means a lot. If you love my podcast, if you love the stories that I put out, then please do follow me on whichever podcasting platform you're listening from. And please do leave a rating. It will really help me a lot. You can listen to me on other platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and any other podcasting platform. If you are in India, you can always listen to my podcast on Gaana or JioSaavn. If you love to listen to strange and mysterious stories, then follow me on Instagram and YouTube, where I put out reels on such stories. These are completely different from the ones that I put out on my podcast, so do follow me on them. If you love travel, you can follow me on my travel channels. I'll link them also in the description. Until then, stay kind and stay safe out there.